It's really like Buckminster Fuller said, you never change things by fighting the existing realities. You need to change something by building a new model. And I think that's what we're doing, a new model that makes the existing one really obsolete.
Great, Dr. Zhang. Thank you so much for your time. I know it's very valuable, but I think before we start, maybe you could tell people a little about where you grew up, what brought you to the UK, and then a summary of what holistic dentistry is versus more of a traditional dentistry practice.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Germany, in Stuttgart. That's the south part of Germany, where some say the best cars are made, Porsche and Mercedes. And I had my Abitur, which is the GDSE that we have in the UK here. And then you go to university. And I was very lucky with my university degree because I wasn't really that good with my Abitur. And so everyone who wanted to apply for medicine, legal studies or dentistry, they got in a big pot and there's a kind of a lottery where they choose 10, 20, 30 people to then start their journey in dentistry. And I was one of the lucky ones. So that is how I got into dentistry. I've never thought I would actually get it because the other ways would be to wait probably 3 or 4 years, or you have wealthy parents that can pay a solicitor to get into dentistry and pay you the way in. So I was in dentistry then, and it was quite a bit of a struggle from school where everything was clear cut and you had a schedule. And then dentistry, you had a bit more free time. Although dentistry is probably one of the most rigid parts that you can do at university because you have quite a good schedule. And on top of that, you had the manual work, you had the intellectual work. So was a really good combination. And when it came to treating patients, that is when it got really exciting because then you were doing the things that you were supposed to do for the rest of your life. And that is where it already then started to become a bit, shall we say, questionable, because back at high school, we were told that mercury is the most toxic substance on planet Earth that's non-radiating. And in dentistry, we are told that, well, as soon as it's in your mouth, it's absolutely fine because it's in amalgamation. That's why it's called amalgam. It's in amalgamation with all the other metals. And so it's fine. It's inert. It stays there. Nothing happens. And obviously, when you get told this from the professor, you first tend to believe that this is what is happening. However, it was still a bit of a question mark behind that. And so I went on a kind of a journey, a search, what is really going on, what's happening with all these things. And so you then meet with other people, you go to areas, to training courses where you meet people who are looking for other ways, for other materials to put in people's mouth. And then you get told, well, it's actually not really sitting there in the mouth and doing all the good things that you are told. And so this is how I then started out into more holistic dentistry, into looking what else there is in dentistry that can be improved.
Dr. Zhang, before we go into the topic of mercury and amalgam, yes, maybe you can give me a context. This is West Germany, correct? Before the fall of...
That is correct. Well, it is in 1981, I started with my...
When you started questioning the professors about the status of mercury, I assume at this point, maybe 100% of the fillings at that time were amalgam or mercury-based, correct?
There were mercury-based, there were some composites, and there were also gold. It was just the first thing that we learned at university.
So before we, I'm just curious, what sparked, you know, this is a very interesting point that you started to question your professors. Where did you get that kind of curiosity to question or to go further? Or did you find yourself rebellious? Where was that? What was the treatment towards your questions?
Well, I had these amalgam fillings myself and was told by the dentist back then that that's all fine. It was just when I was talking with older students or with dentists who were opposed to mercury that I then kind of questioned. But I never questioned the professor, because that would probably end up in me not getting the certificate, and that would be counterproductive. So I kept it pretty much to myself or to the circles that I dealt with. It wasn't something that was openly discussed at university. And I think it's still nowadays a topic that is, yeah, what the professor says, it's done. And if the university is still dealing with amalgam, that is what you do.
One question I was going to ask, because some of your writing about COVID, and it seems to be a little bit more questioning the public health authority. So I'm curious, you said you wouldn't want to question the professor because you might not get your certificate. What the status and relationship with authority and having a private practice is? Because it seems like you shift then towards working in private practice. Are most dentists kind of controlled by an agency or a governing body?
Yeah, we all, whether that's in Germany or in the UK here, we all have to adhere to certain standards. We have to get our certificate to be able to work by, in the UK, it's the GDC, the General Dental Council. And they are big proponents of mercury or fluoridation, root canals, and all these things that you learn at university. And that is whether you work with the NHS, which is the National Health Service in the UK, which gives basic treatment and is funded by the government, or you go in private practices. It's similar to the materials they use in private practice. They still use amalgams. Predominantly, they use composite fillings. And so, yes, we have to adhere to certain standards, and it's not well received if you move away from that, especially if you do it in the way like I do it with my podcasts, with my blogs, and with my public talks.
Well, before we go into that, I'd like just a little bit more on the context of the 1980s in Germany when you're studying. What was the situation of dentistry like in East Germany? Was there a USSR influence? Did you have any contact with that kind of dental practice? Because I know in Russia, they have somewhat a driven tradition of dental practice. So I'm curious if you had any contacts with that.
I didn't have any contacts. However, the very interesting thing is the Russian dentists never used amalgam. I think it was prohibited by the government to use amalgam.
So they were using composite?
They were using composites or gold, yeah.
Very interesting. So maybe we can jump forward a bit towards what breaks you. I think you started under Doctors Graham and Munro Hall. What starts your journey? You get your certificate, and what starts your journey towards finding more of a holistic approach to dentistry and what that is?
Well, I started my first practice still back in Germany in 1991, where I took over a practice together with a colleague from the university. Straight away said, we will not use amalgam. That was clear from the onset. And we were a pretty good practice, very central located, a great clientele. And we had a lot of colleagues who were eager to learn like we are. So we had a circle of 5 to 10 dentists where we invited other specialists to do work. And we had people there for gold inlays, for root canals. So it was a very good time to learn more and to bring more benefit to the patients.
I was going to ask Dr. Zhang, so it sounds quite radical to invite other practitioners into your practice. I mean, every time I go to the dentist, it seems like they want you in and out. There's not much of a concern of the holistic self. It's, you know, how's my mouth? What motivated your practice to really look at the body as a whole. And if you could explain to me, why is oral health separate from general health usually in the West, and your thoughts on that?
That's a really, really good question, because for me, dentistry should really be in the center of it all. And it was one course, one training, one conference for holistic dentists, for natural dentists, biological dentists, whatever you want to call them, where you get ideas, where you see what people, dentists, colleagues who are 20, 30 years older than you, never ever used amalgam. And they tell you about their experiences. They tell you what they experienced with patients once they removed the amalgam fillings, what changes in patients' life have happened. And so you get one course, one colleague, one view. And this all adds up. It's a journey that goes forever, I would say. I'm still learning, and it's a fascinating topic. And at that time in 91, when we first opened, after 2 years, I came about a book from George Meinig, Root Canal Cover-Up. And we just had finished endodontic root canal treatment course in our clinic, ordered microscopes and all the tools for that. And when I read that, I stopped the orders, and I never did a root canal ever since. You can say it was quite radical. However, for me, if I find that the treatment or the materials that I potentially use for clients could harm them rather than doing any good, then I stop. I just don't do it. Root canals is one of the treatments that millions are performed each day in the entire world. It's a way of keeping the tooth in the mouth. And the funny thing is, dentistry is the only area in medicine that thinks a dead organ is a great thing to leave in the body. Everywhere else, if you have a gangrene on your toe, your GP will tell you, we'll better take it off, that it doesn't affect and infect the other parts of your body, because you could potentially die from it. Now, you don't drop dead from a root canal. However, the impact and the effects that a root canal, and we'll come to that later on, have, it's tremendous. And no one looks at these things from that more overall perspective to health. It's as you say, it's kind of a niche part of medicine rather than a center part where it really belongs to.
And why do you think that traditionally is? I don't know the history of the separation of the two practices, but why do you think that continues to be? I mean, there's oral surgeons who are usually more in a medical practice, but, you know, tell me also, going back to the root canal, maybe we can, well, my first question is, why do you think oral health is still so separate from general health? And then two, maybe we can walk through the disadvantages and any advantages of a root canal and what those are.
I think the main challenge is that at university, we're still taught the old way, that we have the teeth, the mouth, the gums, and that is what dentists look at. Dentists are not supposed, they don't learn, they're not educated, not trained to look further than the mouth. We were even once told that we are not allowed to do that. We must concentrate on the mouth. And it's not how a person, a human being, works. When you do something in one area, it has a ripple effect in the other area. And that is why I think whatever we do, we need to look at the bigger picture. We need to look, what can this material potentially do to a person? Now, we have patients who are in their 80s, 90s, they smoke, they drink, they have amalgam fillings, and they don't have any issues with that. And of course, you have these people. But nowadays, with more toxins in the air, in the food, in the water, people are far more susceptible. They have far less power to negotiate with all these toxins. When you look at babies, when they drop out of the womb, they already have more than 200 toxins in their blood. So people are getting sicker, and therefore the compensation capacity is also much lower. And a lot of people eat crap food, toxic food, that doesn't really help to stabilize their overall health.
So going back to your practice then, before we jump into the topic of root canals, how do you then approach patients holistically? Do you work with GPs? Do you work with, are you referred customers? Or how does it really work in your practice to have a holistic approach?
We work with functional medical practitioners, very few GPs, because even the GPs are not used to think teeth or bring teeth into the equation of their patient's health. So it's that we as holistic dentists actually do the entire treatment for the patient to look, let's say we have a tooth that is decayed. Now, from a conventional point of view, a tooth decay is localized on that tooth. We need a drill, we fill it, and that's it. However, from a holistic point of view, we ask ourselves, why is it this tooth? Why is not the neighbor tooth or the one on the other side? And there's a deeper underlying cause for the tooth to decay. There's also a connection between a tooth and an organ, and the organ has connection to emotions, which has connections to the brain. So as proper holistic dentist, you look at all these different angles, and that makes you a much broader therapist for your patient. And then the patients, they find us. We don't really advertise.
And then Dr. Zhang, maybe this is a good point. I really was curious about your meridian tooth chart. Yes. Maybe you can walk me through what that is, the history of that, and how people can use that. That's a very interesting concept to me.
Meridian tooth chart is based on the Chinese acupuncture, and the Chinese have used acupuncture for thousands of years. And we know science has proven that these acupuncture points really exist. So a meridian is a energy pathway that connects certain dots on the body, and every single tooth is connected through these energy pathways to organs. So let's say your four front teeth, the upper and the lowers, they're connected to the kidneys, to the bladder, to the urogenital system, which means that when the energy can't flow properly, that then all those organs, all those vertebrae and glands associated with these energy pathways, they can suffer from this energy not flowing properly. Which means if you, for example, have a dead tooth on your front teeth, that means the energy doesn't flow properly through that meridian and can then consequently cause issues in the kidneys, in the bladder, prostate, urogenital system. And we've seen that. We've seen how problems disappear when we remove root canal treated teeth.
Jumping to the topic of, just to continue for 1 second on the meridian tooth chart, have you experienced any, I mean, I don't know what Chinese dentistry is like. Do they use this type of knowledge or practice in their practice? Or do you work with acupuncturists? How do you navigate this type of knowledge?
Well, we know from the tooth chart how the connection is. I'm not aware of any Chinese dentists, and I'm pretty sure there are holistic Chinese doctors and dentists and conventional ones. And acupuncture is a great way. We haven't got a specialist acupuncturist working with us, but sometimes we get a referral from someone who knows those connections, and then we treat them accordingly as we do with all our patients. Really check them from top to toe, see what is going on with them. So the initial consultation is between 1 and 2 hours.
And then Dr. Zhang, jumping to root canals, maybe you can, you know, for people who aren't familiar with a root canal, is a quick summary, what the thought benefits are, and then what you see as a disadvantage and what you do in your practice.
Okay, a root canal is done when the tooth is deeply decayed or when the tooth has a trauma and the nerve is affected. So the root canal treatment means the nerve, the pulp, the inner part of the tooth, where the nerve sits, where the arteries, the veins are sitting. This is all removed. So the tooth is stripped of these life essences. Then the main channel is broadened so that a lot of bacteria and infected tissue can be removed. And then it's filled, sealed with a material, and the tooth stays there. Oftentimes gets a crown on top so that it's more solid. Now, the big challenge with a root canal treated tooth is that dentists can only fill the main channels. For example, a molar, one of those big chewing teeth on the back of your mouth, they have 3, 4, or 5 roots, and so 4, 5, or 6 of these channels. However, teeth also have many more tiny little channels, and one tooth can have up to 2 or 3 miles of these tiny little channels. And those tiny little channels, they can't be sterilized, they can't be disinfected. And even if you could disinfect, if you could sterilize them, as soon as you stop with that process, bacteria will then migrate back into the tooth and sit there. They eat the proteins that they get from where they're sitting, and they will then have excretes, and those excretes go in the bloodstream and can cause issues. Oftentimes, root canals are not, or root canal fittings are not done to the end of the apex. So there's infection starting, and that is what we then can see on the x-ray. Abscesses forming. So a root canal is also, as I mentioned earlier, a blockage of energy flow. And we can see on the x-ray when there is a issue with the infection, because then you see these black areas around the tooth, and that's where the infection has eaten away the jawbone. And there's also a lot of research, and that is actually back in the 1920s, where George Meinig was a bit later, but Weston Price did research, and he wasn't just any dentist. He was working with the American Dental Association, and he did research on root canal treated teeth. So they took teeth out from patients, root canal treated or dead teeth from patients who suffered, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, and they planted those teeth under the skin of rabbits, and then the rabbits developed exactly the disease the patient was suffering. And those teeth were so full of these bacteria that cause the issue that he had to do that 32 or 33 times in some cases until there was nothing in the tooth anymore and the rabbits didn't fall for the disease that the patient had. So we know that in those dead teeth, a lot of bacteria are stored. And every time you chew, bacteria and their excretes are released into the bloodstream. And then it all depends on your capacity to compensate. If you have a healthy immune system, you might be fine. You can cope with all of that. Now, most patients who come to us, they already have a very weak immune system. They are already suffering from chronic diseases. And so their compensation capacity is very low. And if we then remove these root canal teeth, we increase their capacity to react better. And oftentimes we see a release in their symptoms that they previously suffered.
So your approach to, is it excavation then? Do you just remove the entire tooth and the dead section of the jaw, or how do you approach that? And what do you replace it with?
Yes, that's, we always inform the patient what the options are. So if someone wants to opt for a root canal, then we say, that's a valid option. However, we don't offer that service, and we then refer them to an endodontist specialist, which is very rarely so, because people come to us because they know we don't do root canals, and we provide the service of extracting the tooth. To replace the tooth, there are different options. You can either leave the gap. It all depends on where the tooth sits, what kind of function it previously had. So you can do a small prosthesis, a denture, a little one. You could do a bridge, or you can do an implant.
And what are the challenges with, are those just as, you know, immune damaging as, you know, amalgam or other practices? I mean, a bridge, I imagine not, but what are some of the challenges with veneers or prosthesis or other implants?
Well, with the prosthesis, with the dentures, you need to make sure that the patient is not allergic to the plastic. The good news, the benefit of dentures, it's the least invasive treatment, and it's also the most affordable treatment, which means when patients don't have the finances to go for a bridge or for an implant, this is the way they can then still have a full set of teeth. Real challenge with a bridge is that you have to grind down, you have to file down the tooth either side of the bridge, of the gap, to fit the bridge. And most of the times, these teeth haven't got any decay, any damage, so we dentists damage those teeth, and with that damage, the teeth can become sensitive. Worst case, they can even die. So this is not what we aim to do, bridges. On top of that, when you do a bridge, you strip the tooth from its old mobility, because everything the tooth sits in the jawbone, not like a stone, but like a kind of a mobile organ. So it has a buffer, which is the periodontal ligament, which buffers biting or when you have a hit to your face. So all the teeth, they're a little bit, they can all move a little bit forwards, backwards, sidewards. And so when you put a bridge on, then this movement, the teeth are stripped off. And that's even worse if you do that on the top, on the upper jaw, because that has an impact then on all the bones in your skull. So an osteopath can tell you, a cranial osteopath can tell you when someone has a bridge, because those bones don't move that easily and nicely as they did before, because of those two teeth being together. Great advantage of a bridge, obviously, is in difference to a denture, it is fixed. So you don't have to fiddle around. You brush them like you do with your own teeth, but you don't need to take them out like you need to do with a denture. And the third option, an implant. An implant is an artificial root that is placed into the jawbone. The first implants were made by Brunemark. They were made, I think, from titanium, and that is the material that most dentists nowadays still use. And that's a big, big challenge for the jawbone, because we see a lot of the times we take out a lot of root titanium implants, and the jawbone, in a lot of the areas where the jawbone meets with the implant, we have infection. Because the titanium, little parts of the titanium react with the jawbone and can cause necrosis, infection. And a lot of the implants that we remove, we can unscrew. And that's not what you can do if they are fully healed in. Also, nowadays, I think it's wise to have non-metal materials in your mouth because of all the Wi-Fi. And the EMF, I think, is a clever move to say, I want to go metal-free. And therefore, what we do is we offer zirconia implants. And they are biocompatible. They're metal-free. They heal very nicely. The gum sits very nicely around them. And this is the third option, how to replace a missing tooth.
Dr. Zhang, maybe we can jump into, because you brought up the issue of metals, I know amalgam, I was doing some research on amalgam fillings, and they only seem to be about 10% of the fillings now. I don't know if you disagree with that statistic or not. I think most people under 40, at least in the West, don't have amalgam fillings. Maybe you can give me a quick overview of the risks of those mercury-based fillings and then how you treat that, maybe your SMART protocol and what people who have amalgam fillings, how they evaluate whether they should remove or let them be, or what you suggest regarding that.
Patients who come to us, they still have lots of amalgam fillings, and amalgam is the material of choice still in the UK. There was, or there is, a legislation out now in the EU that the governments have to stop amalgam from the 1st of January 2025. And there was a big outcry from the British Dental Association and the TDC. They say that will break the NHS because amalgam is still the best and most used, best affordable option. So that would say that the statistic you have come from a different country than the UK. In the UK, amalgam is still the most used material, and it consists of more than 50% of mercury. That's already an issue. And unfortunately, contrary to what the professor at the university told us, that it is inert, that nothing happens there, a lot happens. The mercury is released from the amalgam fillings 24/7. If you want to have a look how that works, Google on YouTube, I think it is, smoking tooth. They show exactly from, I think it's a 20 or 30-year-old amalgam filling, and they just rub that with a rubber or with any instrument, and you can see how much mercury comes out. And in the practice where I worked with Graham and Lillian Munro Hall, we had a mercury meter, and the allowance that you have on the workplace, it's 20 microgram per cubic meter. And we had patients already, when we didn't rub the amalgam fillings, that they have 100 or 150 micro coming out of one of their amalgam fillings. And if we then rubbed it, I think the highest level was 1400. So if that would happen in a workplace, they would be shut down straight away, the factory or the office. So we know that mercury, unfortunately, is not staying where it's placed. It also expands over time, which means that it can cause teeth to crack. And every time you chew, when you have a hot food, when you smoke, when you clench or grind your teeth, when you brush your teeth, you release more mercury from the fillings. And then the amalgam, you breathe in the vapor that goes into your lungs, and we know where it goes from the lungs into your blood. And it has a lot of symptoms, physical symptoms, neurological symptoms, hormonal, emotional. So the mercury has the capacity to go through the blood-brain barrier into the brain. It can cause hyperactivity, memory loss. It's also research done that MS and autism have an issue with mercury. We see more anxiety, depression, irritability, confidence loss. And from a physical point of view, it affects your gut, can affect your skin. You might even have a metallic taste in your mouth, especially when you have dissimilar metals in your mouth. Chronic fatigue. I mean, the list, if you Google symptoms of mercury intoxication, this is really, really long. And so, therefore, of course, we don't use it. And even more importantly, when we remove them, we use a protocol you already mentioned, which is the SMART protocol. SMART stands for Safe Mercury Amalgam Removal Therapy. And that means that we do the utmost to protect the client and ourselves, the nurse and the dentist, so that whatever comes out from removing the amalgam filling, nothing really gets into the patient, whether that's a particle of amalgam or more vapor. And this protocol that you can Google, SMART protocol, it's initiated by the EAOMT, the International Academy of Oral and Medical Toxicology, is a brilliant protocol because you are really, really safe with that. And on top of this, it's important that we don't just drill the filling out, we cut the fillings out, which means that we produce even less of vapor, and then we flick the filling out. So we need to drill far less from the filling. And this SMART protocol is very, very important. It gives the patient nasal oxygen, so they breathe oxygen. They have a vitamin C infusion to really help with the detox, because I think vitamin C is still one of the best detoxers for mercury. And so this is very, very important that those safety measures are adhered. Because in the end, the dentists and their staff, they suffer most from that because they're in that environment most of the time. So if you don't do the SMART protocol and you let the vapor out, not only do you intoxicate your patient, also you have this vapor in your office. And there was studies done that mercury doesn't disappear. Even if you have a cleaner coming in every day, the mercury sticks to the floor. So you're always waiting in mercury. So it's very, very important that we deal with this in a very, very careful way. And in my early days, I had a young girl coming in tears with her mom. She was 13 years old. She was looking like, yeah, totally bloated, in pain, had her left leg in plaster. She couldn't go to school. She had memory loss. She was suicidal. The GP done all the tests, couldn't find anything wrong. The blood tests were okay. He talked with the headmaster, and they came to the conclusion that this young girl, Catherine, is making all her symptoms up. It's all in her head. And they sectioned her. They wanted to section her. And mom heard from what we are doing, came to us, and I had a look at Catherine. She had a tiny weeny amalgam filling. The amalgam filling was placed about a week or so before the symptoms started. Now, it wasn't the amalgam filling alone that caused her to get all these symptoms. Her mom had her mouth full of amalgams. And as you might know, during pregnancy, moms detox. So they give a lot of their heavy metals, which mercury is one of them, into the unborn baby. Catherine already came to this world with a lot of mercury, even without having an amalgam filling. And Professor Boyd Haley from Kentucky, he also did a research that when both parents have a lot of amalgam fillings, that it's very likely that the kids can't detox properly. And there's also a genetic part, an APO gene. If you don't have that, then you can even less good detox. So this tiny little amalgam filling pushed Catherine over the edge and made all her symptoms. So I talked with the GP, and the headmaster said, let her with us for 3 months and we see what we can do. And if we don't succeed, you do whatever you need to do. But within weeks, her symptoms disappeared, and it was almost miraculous. After 6 months, she was back to school, brilliant there. So we see that mercury can have, for susceptible people, absolutely horrendous effect.
It's funny because you said the UK Dental Agency was very against the EU's protocol to try to remove it, but the famous story is the Mad Hatter syndrome, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, when you talk to traditional dentists and you go over some of these topics, what is their reaction? Do they think How do you interact with traditional dentists? What's the relationship? Do you try to convince them? Do you just, do they, what's that like?
I did that at the very beginning, and then I thought there's absolutely no sense in really wasting my time speaking with them, because my concern is the patients, not the dentists who don't agree with what we're doing. And a lot of dentists, they must still be of the opinion, if they use amalgam, that it's the best material they can use, and they do it in best knowledge. I can't see how you cannot get to the point where I am, that amalgam is a threat to your overall health. To answer your question, there isn't a discussion with dentists, because I'm not looking for that discussion. I look to really bring awareness to patients, so that they then can question their dentist whether they use amalgam. Because if they use amalgam and they don't use the SMART protocol, you don't want to be in the practice, because even if you only get a checkup, you might get a lot of mercury with you. So I think the change needs to come from the patients. It's unlikely that it will come from the university. It's really like Buckminster Fuller said, you never change things by fighting the existing realities. You need to change something by building a new model. And I think that's what we're doing, a new model that makes the existing one really obsolete. And that is what we're doing with holistic dentistry, to show that this is a much safer and a much better way, not just for the patient, primarily for the patients, also for the environment. Because that's a funny thing also. I mean, it comes to the practice, the amalgam, when it brought into your practice and you have skulls and bones on it. At least it was like that when I first started out at university. And if you remove the amalgam, you need separators, amalgam separators, and they have to be disposed as hazardous waste. So, I mean, this alone should open your eyes to say, well, if it's hazardous when it comes into your surgery and it's hazardous when it leaves your surgery, how can it not be hazardous when it's in your surgery or in the patient's mouth? This it's just a logic that, yeah, that escapes me.
It's funny though, because maybe you can advise how can patients, question their dentist's work? Because, for instance, my daughter's 5 years old and we go to the dentist and I'm asking her about nanohydropexate toothpaste versus fluoride toothpaste. And he looks at me like I'm absolutely crazy, just mentioning the word fluoride, and I'm already, gone down a dark hole for him. His wife, however, is also a dentist. And we come back 6 months later for the cleaning. And she's like, I did a lot of research by accident. And my wife's been telling me all about this nanohydropexate toothpaste. And suddenly the things I was questioning seemed he was open to. So I'm always curious that relationship between the patient and the doctor and how to navigate that. And, they get angry in that power dynamic. How do you approach your patients with their questions? And how can people ask their doctors in a safe way that doesn't get them angry or whatnot?
That's a really, really big challenge. And we hear that a lot of the times, that the slightest approach, a tiny, weeny bit outside of conventional, and they feel personally questioned. This is where they can't really distinguish between the benefit for the patient and an actual professional question. Because we're not questioning the dentist per se with those questions. We want to know what's best for us, and has he ever thought of that? And some dentists, like yours in Hawaii, they're open, or they become open, and they still want to learn, and they look for things. And others, they are really not open. Funnily enough, that is actually a symptom of mercury intoxication, if you become so stubborn and so get a tunnel view. Also, you probably know that dentists, when they are, when their brains are looked at, they have 100 times more mercury in their brain than the average population. And they also have rather high suicidal and alcoholism rate. So this all matches with symptoms of mercury intoxication.
Yeah, I never thought about that because I always thought the suicide rate had to do with their disappointment in not being a traditional doctor. That was my, first stereotype. But now the mercury poisoning actually brings up an interesting point. And I know they also abuse often laughing gas. That's an issue with dentists, correct?
Yes. I mean, I never used laughing gas. We used normal local anesthetics, or if the patient's really, really scared, we get a professional sedationist in from the hospital. And then, so it's a thing in between local anesthetic and general anesthetic. So the patient can still respond, but they are kind of in la la land.
What are your concerns with laughing gas? What's the issues with that, or why don't you use that? And what are the benefits and disadvantages of laughing gas for oral surgery and whatnot?
I've never looked into laughing gas, and I think that sedation is a far more reliable way of really getting the patient into a relaxed state, because you have all the meters there, the machinery there to see. And I mean, I only had laughing gas once myself when I was small, when they removed my tonsils. And yeah, that was a really extraordinary experience. And I really didn't want that. I've never looked into that again. It's either local anesthetic, sedation, or if nothing works, then to the hospital for general anesthetics, which is very, 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 very rare.
So for listeners, Dr. Zhang has an excellent FAQ on mercury and amalgam fillings, which I recommend people check out, and we'll put a link to that. I wanted to jump to another controversial topic. Here in Hawaii, we do not fluoridate the water. Every few years, the Department of Health tries to introduce fluoridization. And my dentist always says, oh, the reason Hawaii has poor oral health is because we don't fluoridate the water. Maybe we can open that can of worms. And people who come from the mainland often think that California has better oral health because of the fluoride issues there. Give me an overview of your thoughts on fluoridization, benefits, disadvantages. Do you still use fluoride in your practice for rinses or?
Well, fluoride is used conventionally to prevent tooth decay. Now, I think that doesn't work. And the Switzerland city of Basel, they've used water fluoridation for, I think it was more than 40 years. And they then went through all the data and they had to admit that the people where they did the water fluoridation, there were no advantages in terms of tooth decay. However, there were disadvantages in other areas of health that weren't apparent in the non-water fluoridated area. So that is just a big, big thing, because we know the Swiss, they are really meticulous with whatever they do. And if they stop something where they think they can save money and prevent diseases, then they would go for it. So tooth decay is definitely not a disease of a lack of fluoride. It's just not. Tooth decay, in my eyes, as well as gum disease, is a systemic disease. And it's a systemic disease that has a lot to do with your diet. Now, what a lot of people don't know, but every single tooth has a self-defense mechanism. Leonardo and Steinman, they discovered this fluid flow that runs from the inside of the tooth to the outside of the tooth if the patient, or when the patient, is healthy. Now, a lot of patients aren't healthy because the gut doesn't work properly. And so this fluid flow is then reversed. And only then, when this fluid flow is reversed, can bacteria actually go into the tooth and do their disastrous work. So it's never, or let's say hardly ever, the bacteria that is causing the problem. Bacteria are, yeah, let's call them opportunistic critters. They use what they are given without bacteria. I mean, we're full of bacteria. If we wouldn't have any bacteria, we would be here. We need them. We need them for all different processes, billions of them. So it's not the bacteria. That's what Pasteur and Bouchon were championing about. Pasteur, up to his deathbed, said it's the microbe that's the problem. And only just before he died, he said, "No, Bouchon, you were right. It's actually the environment." And it's the same in our mouth. It's the environment that makes the problem. And the real issue on top of that, it's a mass medication. We just don't know how much fluoride does a person get. We don't know how many glasses of tap water you drink or how many processed foods you buy and eat, because this is where you have fluoride as well. Do you use nonstick cooking pans? Then there's fluoride and lots of fluoride coming out, especially if the non-sticking part is scratched. You have fluoridated salt. You have dental products left, right, and center. You have the flosses, you have the mouthwashes, you have the toothpaste. And a child of 5 or 6 years old, if they swallow the content of an entire toothpaste, they die of fluoride poisoning. We really need to look at the proper science and not what we hear, what Colgate or whoever tells us that it's good, because we just don't need the fluoride. And the big issue, the symptoms that we find with a fluoride overapplication, discolored teeth, these spotted, mottled teeth, is the least of the problems, but it's an indication. Fluoride reduces your IQ. Fluoride gets you brittle bones. It is a developmental toxin, as research has shown. They use it in concentration camps to keep the people docile. And one of the worst parts is it crystallizes our glands, our pineal gland, which gives us the access to our higher minds, as well as other glands, primarily the thyroid gland. So thyroid gland is very much affected by fluoride. It's very much affected by mercury. It's affected by chlorine, by bromine, fire retardants. So we do not need fluoride, neither in our drinking water nor in our foods. We haven't got any disease that can be healed by fluoride. It's a myth, big myth, and a myth that makes billions.
I'm curious,
Yeah.
what do you think the pressure comes from for fluoridization? You, especially for the water, I don't understand if there's enough evidence and everything. I mean, if my dentist, I brought up the fact that most of Europe doesn't fluoridate the water, Japan doesn't fluoridate the water, China doesn't fluoridate the water. And he keeps thinking, oh no, if Hawaii just fluoridate the water. And he looks at me like I'm just absolutely mad. But he has no answer for, well, why wouldn't Japan fluoridate the water if it's so wonderful? Very rigorous scientific society. So where is that pressure coming from? Who is advocating for this mass medication?
I think it's the pharmaceutical companies. It almost looks like there's a pact between the sugar industry and the fluoridation companies. So if you fluoride your teeth, then you can eat the sweets because the fluoride will keep your teeth healthy.
It's a very interesting topic. To me, you have a very convincing argument. Just the fact that you have no idea how much, even if it did work, you have no idea how much people are drinking or consuming. People buy bottled water, tea. I mean, it's almost useless, even if it did work as an intervention.
Absolutely. And I think we really need to look at this, what happened after World War II in the Nuremberg trials. Mass medication is a real big thing that you mustn't do. The patient needs to give consent to that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting topic. Dr. Chum, maybe we can jump to some other controversial topics.
Sure.
I'd like to know your opinion on orthodontics. How do you approach orthodontics in your practice or for children? What are your thoughts on molar removal? I feel like when I was growing up, everyone's molars were removed. I luckily had mine. I still have mine. So what are your thoughts on that? How do you approach orthodontics and some alternatives for people?
In Europe, and in my case, it wasn't the molars, it was the premolars that were removed. And that is still the case nowadays. So the perspective on that from conventional orthodontists is, well, we let the kids get to their 12, 13 years old. And then all of a sudden we discover, oh gosh, those teeth are crowded. Well, now we need to take 4 healthy teeth out to create more space and to make the crowd go away. Now, that is wrong in 2 ways. A, you don't create more space by taking 4 teeth out because you bring all the others into that spot. So it hasn't gained any space. And therefore, secondly, leaving the child with the same small mouth that it always had. I think better option is to start very, very early. And with very, very early, I mean when the child drops out of the womb. We need to really encourage moms to breastfeed, because with the breastfeeding, this is where the development of the palate starts. If you see a child that is getting its milk from the breast, that is totally exhausted when it has done its job. Whereas if you give a child a bottle, they almost drown in the bottle, but they are not really tired after that. So what happens with breastfeeding? The child places the nipple on the palate and the tongue underneath. So it pushes, it really sucks the nipple empty. And with that action, it pushes the nipple to the palate, and that helps the palate to develop. That's the information the palate needs to really grow and grow and grow. And therefore, breastfeeding is so just for that thing, breastfeeding is so important. And with breastfeeding, the child learns to swallow properly, the child learns to breathe properly, and therefore they will face far less intolerances to food. They will have far less issues with the gut, because everything is working out in harmony. And then when they get older, that is when we start at around 5 years old, we look at habits. Very early, when they are just born, it's also important to look if they have a tongue tie. Because if they have a tongue tie, they can't really do those exercises, those milking, this sucking of the nipple, because the tongue just doesn't get that high. So that's something that needs to be looked at straight away when they pop out of the womb and have it sorted. Then we look at habits. How long do they do the thumb sucking, for example? Is there already a tendency when they're 5, 6 years old to crowding? And then we train the muscles. We don't do anything to the teeth. We train the muscle, because it's the muscle that bring the balance. And so with a system, we use MyoBrace. There are definitely others around. With the MyoBrace system, we train the child to do these, we call them myofunctional exercises, muscle, face muscle exercises. And it's a team approach. It's not just we put the brackets in and let them run and then they come back after whatever time is necessary. It's a team approach. The parents are there to motivate the child to do the exercise, to supervise, to make sure they're doing it. The child obviously must do the exercise, and the dentist is merely a facilitator to make sure everything's going according to plan, revisits every 4 weeks and gives new exercises. And by the time they are 12 or 13 years old, they normally have developed a very broad, a very nice and enough space in the jawbone to hold all the teeth in place. Now, the very interesting thing is also Weston Price, he traveled to all these remote areas and he couldn't see one single person with crowded teeth because these tribes, they chew their food properly. They have hard food. And what do we have? We have smoothies and death boiled vegetables. There's nothing where people really chew on anymore. And over generations, then evolution says, okay, well, if you don't use them, yeah, then you lose them. Therefore, it's very important that we also introduce the kids when the breastfeeding has finished, that they really need to work their teeth, that they have hard things to chew, that they chew steaks, raw carrots, these things, so that there is this constant impact on the teeth. And I think this is also a very, very big thing. And if we compare the, let's call it holistic orthodontics to conventional orthodontics, first of all, the conventional, as I mentioned, needs tooth extraction. This is a very, very traumatic thing for kids. And it's a healthy tooth. Why do that? I mean, God didn't give us all those 32 teeth to rip four of them out just because we didn't start at the right time. And all of the kids or adults who have braces, they know they need to wear retainers because if they don't wear retainers, the whole system will relapse or collapse because the teeth are not at a location where nature would put them. Nature put them in this crowded place because the jawbone wasn't developed properly. So they have to wear the retainer for life. And with the brackets, sometimes there's even enamel damage where they're bonded to, where they're glued to. And having those brackets again on the upper jaw is a massive impact on the skull. It's even worse than you have two or three bridges in your mouth because the bones can hardly move anymore. And again, the cranial osteopath will tell you that. And with those limitations, there are also a lot of emotional issues coming up that oftentimes are negated, they are blocked and not brought to the surface. And a lot of the times later on in life, then these issues surface and need to be dealt with. So I think it's a very, very important topic for parents to be, that they approach that at the right time with the right method so that the child can really sail through young ages with lovely teeth, with healthy teeth, and a really good bite. And only in very, very few occasions, you might need a little bit of a brace to move teeth about when they're in a different angle, for example. Or sometimes teeth are ingrown and they haven't got the space. Then, of course, there's some more intervention necessary. But these are exemptions. The big majority can be helped very, very much with this kind of approach.
And Dr. Zhang, what are your thoughts on adult orthodontics? I mean, it's very popular now, at least in the what here in the US, to have Invisalign and these kind of retainer type bracer products. What are the advantages for waiting till adult, full adulthood to, start using orthodontics? Are there disadvantages in that?
Well, I don't really see an advantage waiting until you're an adult and then have orthodontics. The earlier you do, the more likely the body can react properly and the less force you need to use. Because that's another thing with braces, for example, and it can even happen with Invisalign. If you have the force too much on the teeth, then the roots can absorb, the roots can get smaller and smaller. And with the Invisalign, for example, you need to shave parts of the tooth. I know it's only in the enamel, but still you damage the tooth. So that there is a bit of a mobility there, because otherwise you wouldn't get the movement the movement would just not be possible if you wouldn't create any space. And so therefore they shave off a bit of the enamel to create that space.
And then Dr. Zhang, just to switch topics a bit, could we go a little bit, do you do salivary diagnostics in your practice, or what are your thoughts on the oral biome and how people can learn the importance of that?
Well, that's a very big one, the oral biome. It's almost a brain in itself, like the gut biome, and they interact with each other. So it's very important to make sure that this oral biome works perfectly fine. And again, having a really good diet, and that's debatable, and we can talk about that, what my opinion is on good diet. Having a good diet is paramount to having a good oral microbiome, because everything that changes in the microbiome is due to some environmental changes. It's not all of a sudden you have a steak, a billion of streptococcus are in there and they invade the oral cavity. It's the environment that's there that provides them to grow in a way that is suboptimal. So by having a good oral hygiene, this is obviously a no-brainer, a good oral hygiene and good diet, that really supports a good oral biome. And if patients suffer from, let's say, gum disease, then we can do a microbiome or a test to see what is actually out of balance, which bacteria are out of balance. And we also need to be aware that if you have issues with the gum, for example, then definitely there's a disbalance. And that disbalance can affect other parts of your body. So conventional medicine knows that already, that if you have gum issues, then you have a much higher likelihood of developing endocarditis, for example. And why would it stop at endocarditis? We see gum disease bacteria that then go into the joints. I mean, it's very, very important to have a good microbiome. And if you brush your teeth and the gums bleed, or you floss and it's bleeding, make sure you do the technique in the right way. And once you do it in the right way and it still bleeds, please see your dentist so that he can have a look what is actually going on.
Dr. Zhang, do you have any thoughts? Have you heard of, there's a company called Lumina and others in the US that are trying to sell genetically engineered bacteria that you would put in your mouth as a way to kind of reset your oral biome, almost like a probiotic, but also to replace the quote bad bacteria. I don't know if you've heard of this or what you thought about introducing probiotic type products into the mouth to try to reset or recalibrate the oral biome.
I think it is a good idea to do that. However, it takes away the responsibility for the patient to really look at his diet as his oral hygiene, because then you can just say, oh, well, I pop these probiotics and they'll sort it out and I'll keep doing what I'm doing. And I think that's not the point. And that's where in our practice, we really take very big care that they do the right things with the right tools so that they don't need these things. And another point, obviously, is now after those 4 years that we had and know what gene manipulated things can do, I would be very skeptical of putting anything like that into my body, no matter what.
Yeah, I would be curious to see. I mean, introducing genetically modified anything seems challenging. Let's jump to, I was curious on how does the pandemic and COVID affected your practice? What are you seeing the post kind of COVID issues? Are you seeing people who didn't go to the dentist? What are you seeing in your practice because of the pandemic?
Well, luckily, we have only very, very few patients who have taken on that treatment, the jabs, because it's not an a vaccination, it's a treatment, if we're really honest. And yeah, we have very few. And the ones we have found that their recovery time is so much worse than the ones who haven't had the jabs. So when we have a patient who had two or three jabs, we really sit down with him and discuss what the treatment entails. And we say, we can only do one tooth extraction at a time. Previously, we did three or four extractions in one sitting. And at my time at Munro Hall, we did the upper jaw on one day, the lower jaw the other. And that wasn't an issue. But people, everyone somehow gets less likely to be able to cope with these long procedures over many days. But with the jabbed people, it is clearly that they have a much longer and often not that good recovery after surgery.
Have you seen any, regardless of the vaccine issues, have you seen, I mean, it could be stress or other factors. Maybe the patients who got vaccinated in your practice have higher stress or some other health issue. Have you seen any issues from masking or people who did choose to use masks? Did their oral health get worse or not? And then if you have any thoughts on, quote, mouth breathing, I mean, some dentists argue that mouth breathing is actually more damaging to teeth than even sugar and to cause cavities and whatnot. So I'm curious about that jump and how, you know, the mandatory masking in the UK affected oral health.
I mean, again, we don't see many because most of our clients never wore masks. And we know that mask wearing is the worst thing you can do because those masks that they wore, they might have prevented them from spill, but definitely not from bacteria, because the bacteria, and it said it's a virus. So a virus, if they ever discover one, it's so much smaller than a bacteria. It will go three times through the holes in a mask. So it's absolutely nonsensical to wear a mask to prevent breathing that in. And the funny thing then is, you need to wear a mask when you move in the restaurant, and then you can sit down and can take your mask off. So there must be very clever viruses and bacteria to know that when you're sitting down, they're not allowed to touch you. I mean, the whole thing just doesn't make any sense in the way of health. It makes a lot of sense if you look at the bigger picture. Of course, people need to obey and need to do what they're told, and then we'll see who does and who doesn't. But from a health perspective, from a health protective perspective, mask wearing was probably one of the worst things you could do after the jabbing.
I'm just curious if you saw any issues or talked to other dentists. I mean, you know, children who were masking for the period, did their oral health get worse or better? Or what effect has it had on them, if you've seen anything? Even though your patients might not, but what do you theorize some of those issues could have developed into?
Well, I would definitely say that you have lung issues because you breathe a lot of the things that you breathe into your mask, you breathe in again. So if you're not healthy, you already have a far less clean air that you breathe in. People often use the same mask for days and days or use materials where you really kind of grow bacteria. So more likelihood of pulmonary issues, tooth decay. Absolutely, I would bet that research has shown that.
And then Dr. Zhang, jumping to another topic, one of my last is, what are your thoughts on remineralizing their teeth? How can people strengthen the enamel, you know, evade early cavities? I mean, there's a lot of research on the hydroxyapatite. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah,
if that's a solution or other mineralization and what your thoughts on that.
Okay, I come to that in a moment. We haven't touched the mouth breathing because it's, as colleagues say, a very, very important part. And we check that every time when patients come to us, whether they're mouth breather or not. Because when you mouth breathe, you don't use a lot of the filter mechanisms that you get from nose breathing. And so that already means that you're more prone to breathe in microbes and they go into your lungs that would normally be filtered. Also, if you mouth breathe, then your mouth is really dry. And when your mouth is really dry, then the saliva isn't there. So the saliva can't work as protective solution around your teeth, because saliva actually is the best mouthwash that we have. So mouth breathing is a real dilemma. And mouth breathing is often due to people not having the space for the tongue in their mouth. So the tongue is too far backwards. And therefore, because it's too far backwards, it then blocks the airways. And it's a bit of a cycle. If you can't breathe properly because you are mouth breathing and your tongue's too far back, you breathe even more to your mouth so that you get at least a little bit of air in. So it has effects on many different levels. Also, when you mouth breathe, you very likely do that during the night. And breathing through the mouth during the night means that you do not get that kind of recovery sleep that you would need. So that's what we see a lot when people mouth breathe. They have 8 hours sleep, but they are still tired when they get up. So it is not really a recreation, the night sleep for them. It can become even dangerous if they have sleep apnea. So if they have times when the breathing totally stops. And if you don't use your nose to breathe, then sometimes also the nostrils get more blocked and you're more likely to suffer issues like sinusitis, bronchitis, because you do not have the filter mechanisms on board. And therefore, again, it's so important for children to start breathing properly by really having being breastfed, so that everything develops, that the tongue has more space. Because as long as the tongue has more space, you can do that. And for adults, what we then do, we create appliances so that opens the teeth a bit so that it creates more space for the tongue in a nutshell. And then they have the tongue in a more pronounced position, therefore opening up the airways, and then can breathe better through the nose.
And then what are your solutions for people who are mouth breathing? Are you recommending mouth taping or other interventions?
If they can breathe through the nose, but it's just a habit breathing through the mouth, then we recommend to do the taping. That's a good way. And if that doesn't work and they have real issues, we send them to a sleep lab.
Yeah, very interesting. I think, yeah, no, you can see it in early children. You can definitely see which children are mouth breathers or not. And the connection to oral health is very interesting. So going back to remineralization, if you have any thoughts on remineralization and hydroxypite, I'd be interested in that.
I think it's a great mineral to use. However, again, if we have a balanced diet, a diet with really grass-fed, grass-finished meats, raw butter, raw dairy, and raw honey, for example, this is a diet where we don't need any additions, because those animals, they give all that to us. Also, the idea of helping someone who hasn't got great teeth is a good one. I would still go back to basics. What is your diet look like? What is your lifestyle looking like? What are your habits like? And if we then look into that, I'm pretty sure that we can help 80, 90% of people make changes, and then they can save the money that they will use for these common things. If you buy a toothpaste with hydroxylapatite, absolutely fine, go for it. I just think we need to go to the root the problems rather than just masking symptoms.
Great. So maybe Dr. Zhang, we can go into, what do you think the future of holistic dentistry is? What do you imagine? What are you focusing on for the future? What are you education? What's your main You really think getting people to improve their diet, and what else?
Well, diet is definitely a basic one that we really need to look at. If we see, and we see a lot of people who come to us who are vegan or vegetarian, and their health isn't often as good as that of people who have meat in their diets. So if you have an exclusive, or an excluding, I should better say, an excluding diet like vegan, where you don't eat meat and many other products, you need to be very, very meticulous how you really get all the minerals and vitamins. If you don't get it from the eggs, the butter, the meat. So you need to be very smart and take a lot of time to get a good plan in. And I still think it's not ideal. We humans, that is my opinion. That is how I eat. I think we're made for having meat. We're hunter-gatherers. I don't think we are made for only eating grass. We're eating away the animal's food. No, that's a joke. However, there's also the argument of, oh, I can't do it for moral or ethic reasons because I don't want to kill an animal. Now, if we look at the bigger picture here as well, and you look at harvesting grain in these monocultures, how many millions of animals are killed in this harvest? Tiny little animals, little deers, rabbits. I mean, if you kill one cow, you can feed a lot of people, but the millions of little animals that are killed in those harvests, I mean, you can't even compare that. So I think that argument is on quite fragile pillars from the vegetarian and vegan.
Dr. Zhang, how do you recommend prospective patients not just network with you, but network with a better dentist or a holistic dentist? What are some strategies on how they approach their oral health and how to find the right dentist for their needs?
I think the three things that really important is that by education, they raise their awareness. And thanks to podcasts like yours, Robert, this is absolutely fabulous. So we bring the education home to them. They can listen to podcasts. They can listen to people who are on the journey as well. They go on, for example, Facebook or other social medias where there are groups that have been through certain diseases, have had holistic dental treatment and got better. So they will also develop a discernment to know what to trust and what not to trust, what makes sense, what is common sense. And so they will then more likely be able to take responsibility for their health. I think these are the three main goals that I always have when I do podcasts or public talks, that people just need to be aware. And then things go and come into motion almost on its own. And I think that holistic dentistry is the way forward. It's the only way forward in my books, because only if we look at the patient as a whole person can we really heal them. We don't want to treat symptoms and push things under the carpet. We want to really go for the source for that. We haven't touched one very, very important point, which I hope we come to in a moment. So it's the awareness, it's taking responsibility, because we're kind of used to go to the dentist, and yes, we should trust them, but we should also have some kind of discernment, because if they, as we discussed, have only the old knowledge, then they will only do the old treatments. And there is change. If we look back in the very early days when amalgam started, there was an American Dental Association prior to the one now, and they didn't allow members who use amalgam. They didn't allow members to use fluorides. And so only when that changed and the American Dental Association as it is now they then threw out the members who were against amalgam. So already in the very early stage, that was in the 1900, 1800 even, people, dentists knew that mercury in the body isn't the best thing to do. So I think that the main pressure on dentistry will come from patients who gather that it's more than drill, fill, and bill. There's more to things. And we haven't even touched the issue of composite. So you really are enthusiastic that you get your mercury removed, the amalgam fillings come out, and now you get the plastic in. Well, what about the plastics? They can be as bad as the amalgams if you get the wrong ones, because most of the composites have fluoride in them. Most of the composites have bisphenol A in, which is a hormone disruptor. So we really need to look that when we replace something, that we replace it with something that really makes sense and that is not as toxic as the things that we had in before. Yeah, it's definitely coming from the patients. And we see that more and more people inquire, what are we doing? How do we do? Do we do this? Are we using the smart protocol? So people get into the subject already before they come to us and they ask us questions. And I think this is absolutely brilliant. If you talk with people on the same level and exchange thoughts, I think this is the way to go. Absolutely.
It's funny. The joke I think that one of my dentist friends says is that when he, you know, all his patients are either of two types. The first comes in asking with questions, and if they have a toothbrush, they can immediately use to brush their teeth before the cleaning. And the other are the people who never think about their teeth and come in just expecting the dentist to solve their problems. Yeah. I don't know if you have, maybe your practice is the first type, I assume, with people who are maybe with problems, but working with you as well.
Well, I think we're in a very good situation because when people come to us, they either come by word of mouth or they researched for that kind of dentistry. We're not a high street practice. We're in a remote area and people come to us because they want to come to us, not to a dentist. So we definitely have a bit of a different clientele. They know, but still there are some there and they put all their hope in dentistry. And if we then look into diet, into lifestyle, then they become aware that there are more areas to healthy teeth than just what the dentist can help them with.
Dr. Zhang, I really appreciate your time. Is there anything else we could go on for? You know, I think your website has, you know, you have your own podcast series I recommend people listen to, your book. What else can people, anything else you want to share with people? I think your message here is that, you know, oral health is a gateway towards general health.
Yes, one very, very important part, and that is what we only discovered a few years ago, and that's emotions. Emotions play a very, very important part in our health, and mainly those emotions that we're not aware of, those emotions that are blocked, those emotions that have had an impact on us and then were just not taken on. And we have seen that especially with surgical patients, in a way that when we did surgery on patients, for most patients, the surgery went well, it healed, and everything was good. But a few patients, about 6 months, where everything went really good, the symptoms disappeared almost completely, and then symptoms came back. We did another surgery, and the same thing happened. And so we thought, what is really going on here? And then we came to a treatment modality called light kinesiology. We developed that further, brought in German New Medicine and Dr. Bradley Nelson's emotional code. And we discovered that we must heal those underlying emotions that are connected to that area in the jawbone where we do the surgery. And since we do that, since we clear those emotions, we do not have patients where we need to redo surgery. It's a very, very big part. And on top of that the healing is very good, which we can test with our Capitao ultrasound machine, which is the only one in the UK in our practice. This shows us the bone density, and that is, after 6 months, after a year, absolutely fabulous. On top of that, we have the brilliant healing. We also see changes in people's personalities. Anxiety disappear. People become more confident. This was a major, major game changer for us. And it's very important to always bear in mind that there is emotion behind that can be traced into the brain, to specific areas. And if you find a practitioner who can help you with that prior to any surgery, this is a real, real gift.
So how are you encouraging? I know on you had a podcast about hypnosis. What other techniques are you getting people to be cognitive of their emotional health and the relationship to their general health?
Well, we have a practitioner who is kind of a healer, a shaman, NLP master coach, and she's done a lot of 20, 30 years, and she developed that. So patients who have surgery, they will have a session with her. And the really good thing is, because we have a lot of patients from all over the world, it can be done remotely. So they don't have to travel in before the surgery to have that done. They can have it done in their home. And it works as well as in person. And we've done it as a mandatory session prior to surgery. If someone doesn't want that treatment, we have them sign consent forms that we can't guarantee that the treatment will work the way that we intend to do. Because we've seen our protocol is so strict, it's always the same how we do things. So we know that the protocol works. And with removing those blocked emotions, it's just absolutely brilliant.
No, I think it's very interesting. I think my main takeaway is that, you know, like you said in the beginning of the call, you would like oral health to be the nexus or the center of health. And I think that's a good way for how you approach your practice. Anything else you'd like to share, Dr. Jung? How can people find you?
Well, it can go on my website. Yes, you already mentioned there is a podcast. There are, and I would also love to give their ebooks on my shop. So if listeners want to download those, then put in free ebooks in the discount and they get it for free. So a bit of a motivation to dive deeper into the topic of oral health, of holistic health. And I think, yeah, podcasts, YouTube channel are all really good information, or my book, Shut Your Mouth and Open Wide, which they can probably get on Amazon. And if someone wants an online consultation wherever they are in the world, we offer that as well. So there's lots of information out there. And I'm really grateful and thankful, Robert, that you offer that opportunity to bring that topic out to your listeners. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, Dr. Jung, thank you so much for your time. I know it's late for you, so I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. All the very best.